And it's 2:49, 2:50. And we are going to listen now to our first Gene Shepherd broadcast of the morning. I'm glad I came prepared. And we turn from Ireland. We're going to move on over to Paris and hear of Mr. Shepherd's exploits and adventures in Paris as he related them on his broadcast on WOR on June 15th of 1966. Gene Shepherd, right here on, I guess, what has now become an extended edition of Mass Backwards here on WBAI New York.
Admit, Corny, that I look ready tonight. Have you noticed that? What a fathead. What are you giving me to drink? You want to buy a duck? All right, now look. Now let's set the scene. Have you ever in your life just, it maybe happens two or three times in a guy's life, where he is suddenly plunged into what could be almost described as a peculiar, inverted, fantasy, nightmare, impenetrable scene that looks so much like something that he has maybe seen before or imagined before or dismissed before that he can't believe it? All right, listen carefully then. Here's the scene now. This is a true story. Now, I'm not going to give you any preface as to how this happened, because how it happened is too long, and that would take four more quarto volumes to get into it. Because these scenes, it doesn't matter how it happens. It has happened. There you see me, your old friend, me. There you see me, and I am now sitting on the floor of an apartment in the heart of Paris. You got the scene? I'm sitting on the floor, scrunched down, and we are all gathered around a low marble coffee table that looks like it's at least 400 years old. And on the wall are these ancient stained French prints. It is an apartment of almost exquisite sensibility, of almost painful civilization, you know? It's that kind of apartment where you feel that the taste is so muted and so quiet, so casually calculated, and yet so long drawn out in an infinite number of mirrored walls and years that go back to perhaps the even beginnings of the French people, that one does not question. A terrazzo floor. And I'm sitting down with my knees cracking, you know. The first thing you begin to notice about the truly civilized Frenchmen is they're little. They're little people. You've noticed this, Corny? Little, natty people, and their suits all are kind of cut in at the waist. They have little thin pants. and they wear sparkling white shirts, little thin ties, and all of their hair is very thin on the top. I've noticed this among hundreds of the truly, you might say, the end line of decadent families. And I am sitting down on that floor, that terrazzo floor, and I am slowly spooning Iranian caviar, a dark, gray, succulent caviar, on thin French bread. I am squeezing the lemon on it, and I'm with a group of people who are total strangers to me. And finally, the man who has brought me here, who is a young French count, arises. It is his apartment, which is only perhaps a spit and a half distance from the Arc de Triomphe, right in the heart of Maurice Chevalier country. He gets up and moves to the record player. And a moment or two later, we begin to hear the sound of Spanish guitar music filling the apartment. My friend Renaud has put on his record player, his Columbia 360 record player. And sitting across from him in this little soiree is his wife, Felice. And next to her is Gerard. Gerard, a tall, thin, aesthetic, a kind of epitome of French taste, a young up-and-coming avant-garde, and yet with touches of the Gothic, interior decorator and architect from the Sorbonne. And next to him is his wife, Colette. Oh, la, la, Colette. Colette, the epitome of the French girl, of the true, let's say, the sexy de la maison, the sexy lady of the house. And next to her is a Corsican, a tall, thin, languid Corsican named Philippe. Philippe, who I have discovered listening to their involved, subtle, beautifully muted French conversation, Philippe has traveled all the way up from Corsica, his home, to spend 3 days in an attempt to see if he can make any time with Colette, who is the wife of Gerard, the young architect. And sitting next to me is Renaud, the husband of the family. And it was suddenly I found myself in the middle of a Guy de Maupassant short story. The subtle interplay of sexual inferences, and by the way, the French are exceedingly, particularly if you get high enough up in the circles, very graphic. Very graphic in their stories. And I am sitting in the middle of all this, attempting to grab a hold of it, attempting to somehow be part of this swirling scene right out of Waron, a bad French farce. And I begin to realize that these French farces are not really French farces. That's the way the French really are. I couldn't believe it. And all night long, the Corsican sat attempting to make time with Colette. They nuzzled. He nibbled her ear. And all the while, Gerard, her husband, paid not the slightest attention. It is just Colette's little game. And later he said that to me. It is Colette's little game. I cannot take from her her hobby. I said, her hobby? She says, everyone has his hobby. She has hers. Oh, I have mine. I have never felt more like a man from the great frontier plains than I felt that night. This quiet, muted little interplay of subtle nuance. And all the while I sat hairy, kind of big, a kind of bulking. And I'm not a big, bulking man. But in this company, I was a big, bulking, hairy man. I felt somehow that I had been transmuted into King Kong among the Lilliputians, among these little Napoleonic prints hanging on the wall. And about 10 minutes after the last smidgen of caviar had disappeared and the first bite of cold chicken was beginning to be enjoyed by the company, a little French bread and a subtle Alsatian wine, the company begin to warm to its task of civilized interplay, the intercourse of subtle minds. Now, I'll hold it there, Corny. Now, just a minute. I'll give you another cue. Let's hold it there for a minute. See? Now you got the scene. Well, this was in Paris, and I have been in Paris many times, but I've rarely been in Paris the way I was 2 weeks ago. And you've heard a lot about Paris. You know, so many people talk about Paris. There's more movies about Paris, and they're all cliches, I find. Just like the movie about New York is always a cliche. You always have the scene of the Empire State Building, and you have, you know, this stuff. They never show you the Grand Concourse in the movie. And whenever they make a movie, somehow Queens is left out. They never include Flushing as part of New York. Well, that was the beginning of a weekend, the likes of which I have never spent anywhere in any foreign country, really. Because I began to see the American against the backdrop of an older civilization, I don't want to be pompous about it, and an older civilization that was alternately jealous of the new civilization and resentful of that new civilization, and at the same time embracing that new civilization. And so after we had finished the last bit of chicken, the little poulet, after we had sipped the last of the Alsatian wine, vin ordinaire, we were out on the dark streets of Paris, whistling through the night in two French automobiles of particular anger, whistling through the darkness on our way towards what Renault described to me. He says, I wish to show you some of the life American. American life is very deep. And we Parisians have many things which are very much like the American. And we wish to show you that. I wanted to see what they considered an American life. He says, how would you like to go to the drugstore? I says, the drugstore? It never would occur to me in America to say to my friends, how about going to the drugstore with me? And he says, the American drugstore. And always around everything he said was a kind of vague tongue-in-cheek putting down, you see. That this is American. This is American life, of course. We don't take it seriously. It's a bore, however. And so we arrive at... I wonder whether... do any of you know what is currently, right now, the big topic of conversation? The big topic of conversation in Paris, and indeed all of France... I mean, other than anything political, what everybody really is talking about. Wherever you go in a cocktail party, you hear this. Wherever you go, where six people gather to wait for a bus, somebody will mention it. And wherever you go, you ride down a great boulevard or the Place de la Concorde, everywhere you look, you see great posters talking about this. And in spectacular colors, magnificent design, wherever you go. And he says to me, he says, I shall take you tonight to show it to you. And so we head out into the French countryside to see what the French consider part of the American way of life. And it really is about as American as, let's say, an average weekend on Mars would be like. It bears no relation. You know what I found in my world travelers, for what it's worth? That anything that the people in the neighborhood, in any country, wherever you go, wherever I've gone, whatever they relate to modernity, whatever it is modern, and they vaguely don't like it, they ascribe to America. Even if there's nothing at all in America remotely like this, that whatever a Frenchman does not like about the new France, he says he's American. Even though... But it's nothing. It's their own brand of 20th century insanity. Somehow, the world has discovered a fantastic scapegoat. That if the kids break the windows along a string of shops, that's just because they have been seeing the American movie. They are attempting to be like Heap, the American beatnik. It's all, and yet whatever they like, they ascribe, of course, to themselves. And so we go whistling out through the darkness. I was having a fantastic time because immediately I began to dig them, they began to dig me, and they began to open up to me. And pretty soon, one of the worst insults you can ever get as an American, at least me, to me, is when they turn to you and say, oh, yes, but of course you are not the ordinary American. Somehow implying, of course, that all Americans are slobs and idiots, fools and knaves, but you are the different one. Now, on the other hand, I then began to do the opposite to them. I said to Renault, but of course you are not the average Frenchman. The average Frenchman, he spits on the street. He throws the beer cans out on Place de la Concorde. He drives like he is an idiot. He steals the antenna right off the Fiat. He is a slob, idiot. He knows nothing of politics, of course. Ooh, he's purple. Because I'm giving back to him what he's giving to me, and then there was a kind of funny silence because they're not used to getting it back, you know, in their terms. And so we are whistling out through the night, and we are in the direction, we are going in the, I will award you a brass figure if you think you're a traveler. I don't care what you read, the little profiles of what's happening in Paris and in the New York, and that they never talk about the real things that are happening in a country. For example, if you get to New York, you know, there's a letter from New York in the British newspapers. It's always written by some a faith person like Alastair Cook. And he talks about what's really happening in New York. And I'm there, you see. I'm in Paris reading what's happening in New York, and I don't recognize the New York I've just left. Because he's never talking about the things that are really happening, like the Mets have won 3 straight. And everybody in town's talking about this. You know, this is really what's happening. Or the kind of things that you and I talk about continually in our little life, in our little walking around, scratching, spinning life, that there is the equivalent in Paris. There is the equivalent in Bangkok, the day-by-day life. And I will award you a brass fig de gui with bronze oak leaf palm if you think you're a traveler type and you've been to France in the last year and a half, or maybe the last year. What is it that they are speaking of now, today and tonight in Paris? Huh? What is it? Hey, it is not the sex. It is not the new wave movie. Oh, no. What is it, huh? Yeah. This is WOR, AM and FM, New York. We will award you the brass fig leaf with bronze oak leaf palm if you can tell me what it is. It's a peculiar thing. Hit the button, will you please?
Miller High Life, the bright, clear tasting beer. Miller High Life, champagne bottle cheer.
There's only one champagne of bottle beer. Sparkling, flavorful, bottle. Distinctive. Da-da-da. Miller High Life. Brewed from a century-old recipe, Miller High Life has a rich heritage and tradition. A bright, clear taste. Unequaled, unquestioned, unchanging. Available on tap, in cans, and in familiar crystal clear bottles. Miller High Life is always sparkling, flavorful, distinctive. Enjoy Miller High Life yourself. Yes, Miller High Life, the champagne of bottled beer.
Oh, I did find out one thing. You know that it is very hip in Paris today to drink the Milwaukee beer? Oh, yeah. That wherever I went, and I don't sell beer, but wherever I went, I was kind of proud of that thing, to find out that in France, in Paris, they consider the really expensive great beer is when somebody comes out with a bottle of genuine Milwaukee beer. That's very, very hip, very big. Do you know that you pay more in most French restaurants for la instant coffee? To them, instant coffee is the superb coffee. Yeah, it's on the menu. It says instant coffee. It's like 15 cents more if you want to really spread yourself and get instant coffee. Can you imagine what you would do here in America if they had on the menu instant coffee? You'd flip. You know, you'd throw the menu right back at them. You know, even if it was Rikers, you say, what do you mean instant coffee, Mac? I, you know, And yet, this is the thing that that they enjoy. Speaking of, you have another one in there for me? Hold up. Before you do that here, let's get the Woolmouth out of the way. You want to hear more about France? I'll tell you, France is one of, particularly Paris. Of course, I spent the weekend, I got a car, and I went way out in the country. I went 75 miles out in the country. I spent a couple of hours at a chateau, and then went to something that I'll guarantee you. Do you know that there is a desert in France? You know there's a desert in France? And I'll award any of you a brass fig to gee if you can tell me where that desert is in France. And I went to the desert, right, in France. Let's see, we have, let's see, Woolmouth. Does warm weather give you a license to walk around in a wrinkled suit of pajamas? Yeah, actually, now that you're asking me there, Woolmouth, old man, let's face it. That's what some ready-made summer suits look like about halfway through the morning. But if you take special pride in your appearance, if you're a fop, then you'll want Woolmouth to make your summer suits to your measure. You'll look like you're wearing beautifully cut pajamas. Woolmouth clothes bring you the perfect combination. Fine fabrics, custom design, careful tailoring. That's Woolmouth. W-O-H-L-M-U-T-H. Woolmouth clothes. And you'll find them listed under tailors in your directory. Hit the button, Corny.
Dear Americans, I'm here to tell you about honor. Many years ago,
Cinzano
decided that Italian grapes were fine for Cinzano sweet vermouth, but just not the dry enough for Cinzano dry vermouth. They insisted that Cinzano French dry vermouth would make a drink taste nice, very nice.
He's a worse Italian than I am.
Being born Italian, and letting Frenchmen make their dry vermouth, the people of Cinzano were bitten by their dogs, fed the mushy spaghetti by their wives, and treated them. Not very good.
But
in their poor, honorable hearts, they knew that Cinzano French dry vermouth was the best
dry vermouth. Didn't buy the dogs.
My American friends, after all of that trouble, what do you know about Cinzano, huh? That we make ashtrays. Americans, you're some friends.
You're such a slob.
And Co., New York.
You're Americans are slobberinos. Oh, by the way, you know how I like Cinzano? Personally, I like Cinzano Blanc, which is the light, lighter color. There's a light Cinzano, and there's the Cinzano Rouge. If you ever had the Cinzano Blanc, which is the light Cinzano, on the rocks with a little bitters in it, just a little, about two drops of bitters in it, and a twist of lemon peel. Oh, la la, this is the drink. This is the Aphrodite. I mean, this is a drink. Let's see, what do we have here? Honda. Honda motorcycles. And someday, I suppose, when America becomes civilized, people will learn the delights of riding on two-wheeled conveyances, which you do find in almost every other country. And I personally, for 5 years now, have had a tremendous amount of enjoyment, personal enjoyment, every weekend on my motorcycle. And if you are thinking of making the big leap, I suggest you consult with Fleischmann. This is Fleischmann Honda. They have all the great Honda machines, ranging all the way from the little 50cc putt-putts to the big competition bikes. The one that I happen to be using now is a Honda Super Hawk, a 305, which is a lot of machine, by the way. And I would highly recommend a visit to Fleischmann. Now, they have five dealerships throughout the island, and they can insure these for as little as $24 a year. They'll teach you how to ride it, and they'll make sure that you're safe and you know what you're doing. They have one in Long Beach, on Long Beach Boulevard, West Islip, Bayshore. They're both on Sunrise Highway. There's one out in Queens in Woodside. It's about a mile west of the new Macy's. And there's one out in Douglaston, Long Island, Fleischmann Honda. Okay? One more note here. We have Rover with us. And I have threatened from time to time to do a show. In fact, I think one week I will do a show on the great automobile designers, which you don't hear much about in this world. You hear about the guys that design bodies like Bertone or Farina, but not many people know about the people who design cars, who design the running gear, who design the suspension and so on. And two of the most famous designers of the last 15 years collaborated on the Rover 2000 TC. It stems from the BRM. You've heard of the BRM that races a lot, the Grand Prix racing? Well, the suspension system and so on was designed by the same two people who designed the original BRM Grand Prix machines. It's a great machine, a great piece of business, and that's the Rover 2000 TC. Great car. And let's see, one more note. I am going to be out at Yankee Stadium this Saturday. I will be at bat, I would say, about 15 minutes past 12. And I want a few of you out there so that when I step up to the plate and the PA announcer says before, what a feeling, boy, when it's echoing from one end of the stadium, the other,
now stepping to the plate, number 11, playing third base, Shepherd. Number 11, Shepherd.
I want to hear just one little cheer. One small little cheer, like go, go, you know, or something. All right, let's return to reality. Give me a little of that that music there. It's very hard to know where reality stops and the dream begins, you know, in this world. In fact, there's a great deal of question as to whether they do stop. In fact, there is a question now, philosophically, whether either of the terms are valid. Reality and dream. Now, bring that up. We liable to find ourselves in the middle of a deepie here unless we watch it. Da-da-da-da. Me and Samuel Beckett and Earl Wilson. Bring it up. There you go. Well, I'll tell you, we are whistling through. Have you noticed not one person has called in? What? There's not one has called in and told me what is the number one topic of conversation in Paris. I'll give you a clue. Connie, here's the clue. I'll give you a clue. It is a construction of a kind, of a sort. In other words, it's not a book. It's not an idea, although this could be called an idea. I was dumbfounded to find that the Parisian thinks of this as an American concept. And it has nothing whatsoever to do with anything I have ever seen in America anywhere. And I've been all over the country at one time or another. And it is considered to be an American concept. Now, well, hang it up there. They don't know. Because the word... what it is that they're talking about in France can be, all you have to do is tell me one phrase. It is one word. There is a name to this thing. It is not an idea. It's not what de Gaulle is going to do about NATO. As a matter of fact, you know, I found that most Frenchmen that I had talked to, there's a funny feeling about de Gaulle. A kind of ambivalent feeling about de Gaulle. And they sort of shrugged their shoulders and said, well, this is me. This is de Gaulle, you know. That's all they say. And I say to them, well, do you like de Gaulle or do you like his ideas or what? And he says, well, this is de Gaulle, you know. And I can never quite find out what they think or what they feel. Well, anyway, since obviously nobody knows what it is that I'm talking about, there are posters all over France advertising something. Have you got that other cut up there? That other one? Oh, hold it there. I'll show you. Hold it there now. All over France, you see these gigantic posters. And there they are, hanging there, beautifully done, superb design. These posters are advertising something called Paris 2 or Paris 2. Yeah. Paris 2. Paris number 2. And what is Paris 2? Ah, this is an American idea. This is very hip. You know, I'm a little surprised to find that every morning as I stood before my mirror and shaved in the heart of Paris with my little transistor radio on, listening to FM, all up and down the dial, I heard American folk singers named Red Foley. They weren't even folk singers. There's a phrase that's used, something kickers, I remember. And they're singing, I'll be coming round the mountain when she comes. And in between it, In between every one of those stations playing American music, there are hundreds of stations playing this kind of French music. Believe it or not, they still listen to it there. It's hard to believe. Yeah. It just sort of floats out all over France, all over Paris. And I am sitting out on the sidewalk at Café François, enjoying an aperitif and the sounds of Offenbach rise. I'm the greatest sidewalk sitter that you ever saw in your life. Oh, this is the way to leave. Café François. Very good. Now, I'll tell you, it's no use to call any longer because I've already told you that the number one conversation in Paris is Paris 2. Now, what is Paris 2? Well, it's hard to explain it because there isn't really much of a parallel in America to it, even though in Paris there is the myth going around that it is an American idea. And as we drew closer to it, it looked like we were approaching Disneyland, a kind of Disneyland. And it's way out in the French countryside somewhere. We drove up and down through the lanes and past little villages and through tiny streets with walled houses until suddenly we burst out on a hillside and there it was, Paris 2. How can I describe Paris 2? Well, I think I will begin to say that they think it's an American housing project. You know what they call luxury American housing, the kind of thing where you buy an apartment. It's a cooperative apartment. But actually what it looks like when you get close to it, I've never seen anything in America remotely like it, because first of all, it's way out in the country. And it looks vaguely like, hard to describe it. I'm really thrown here because there's no parallel. I can't quite think in terms of what. It's all glass to begin with, but not glass in the American sense. It's as though everyone is living in some kind of a display case. I'll tell you what it really looks like. Have you ever driven through along the Jersey Turnpike and you've looked down from the turnpike and you could see the Howard Johnson Motel that's up there on the hill, and it's all lit up a kind of an orange colored, and the orange, it's all kind of orange light and all glass, and it has a sort of motel. It's motel, but it's a kind of fairyland motel. It's not motel in the old sense, the little shacks all one after the other, little TV antennas, but it's that fairyland quality that Howard Johnson architecture throws to it. Orange lights and green lights and kind of plastic eaves rising up. Well, here is Paris 2. And Paris 2 is, believe me, is really controversial in France. A group of French builders have built this fantastic cooperative housing project just outside of Paris. And they sold, it opened the Sunday before I was there. And in one Sunday, they sold, now get this, sold 1,100 apartments. And the lowest price apartment went for the equivalent of something like $18,000. And they went all the way up to maybe $60,000, $65,000 in this peculiar, strange-looking, other world, vaguely fairyland, vaguely Howard Johnson, vaguely Texas. It has no relationship, though, to anything I ever saw in America, even though I may be describing it in American terms. And yet everybody in France believes firmly that this is one of them American ideas. Very bad. And I couldn't explain it to these people. This is an American. And so we drove around through Paris 2 and looked at the people all living in their kind of strange display case. You could see them walking around and holding their martinis and so on, and they have a big swimming pool in the middle of it. And then the genuine center, the hub of this establishment, the Paris 2. And I at this point I'm having a wild time. I'm really enjoying myself because the people are beginning to warm up, you know. Gerard was beginning to feel his Alsatian wine, and Colette was beginning to tell dirty jokes in the French, and Philippe was beginning to feel his oats, and Felice was having her fun, and Renault was nervous. He was with me. He was supposed to be showing me the better side of France, and now they're all drunk. And we were having a wild time. And so he says to me, he says, you wish you go to the drugstore. I says, the drugstore? It never occurred to me to go out on a big night on the town and go to the drugstore. And so right in the middle, now get this, this is in the country, friends, way out in the country, which would be like the equivalent of being somewhere near, if you're going to think in terms of the East Coast, somewhere near Flemington, New Jersey. I mean, you know, there's nothing. Well, right out in the country, on the hillside, is this thing. It looks like a sort of strange... Do you remember the World's Fair building that was built on the... built by, I believe, the Travelers Insurance? It looked like an umbrella. Do you remember that building with the big red umbrella? Well, this thing is sitting on a hillside. It looks like a big mushroom, all lit up, fantastic lights all the way around. Inside of it, there must have been 1,000 light globes hanging at all different angles and lights, and it was lit inside like a stage set, yellow, green, purple, mauve, amber spots all over the place. And there it was, sitting on the hillside, a big thing. Oh, it must have been the size of, a football field at least, a big thing. Right there on the side. I couldn't figure out what it was. He says, this is the drugstore. And we drove closer, that big clover leaf all in front of it, a gigantic parking lot. And the place is mobbed with people, all sitting at different levels in big plush white round booths. They weren't even booths. They were like nightclub, almost like, I can say, perhaps, do you remember when they used to talk about conversation pits? Well, these were all set at levels, gigantic, big things, all white and puffy and sort of 1933 Jean Harlow styles. You know, the big white, puffy, sort of fluffy boudoir kind of things. It's all very feminine, by the way. And inside of this place, they are selling cashmere sweaters. They have all kinds of little shops. Cashmere sweater girl over here. Here's a very, very expensive perfume shop. And they have absolutely no drugs anywhere. The drugstore in Paris has done away with drugs. You cannot buy... I said to myself, well, I'll buy some razor blades, you know. I was looking for razor blades. Forget it. This is not a drugstore. I mean, it's just called a drugstore. And all the lights. And the place is blaring. You can't... It just... It's throbbing with rock and roll music. And everyone is quietly sitting. Nobody's dancing or anything. It's not a discotheque. But they're all in these conversation pits. And these French waiters are hurrying back and forth, up and down, and they're bringing frozen oranges, and they're bringing pressed duck, and they're bringing this magnificent food and ice cream and the whole business. And we sat down in this thing. I've never seen anything in my life like this. And we sit down, and Gerard turns to me. Gerard, the architect. And he says, this is the sort of things which I think has made the American... not very well liked anywhere. This kind of American thing we have here. He says, this is fun to go to, but this is not French. I said, that's not French. Are you kidding me? French? I don't know what it is, Gerard, but it ain't American. He says, oh, come, this is America. This is an American drugstore. I said, no, this is not like Liggett's. This ain't like Walgreens. This is like no drugstore I've ever... I've been in the drugstores out on the West Coast. I've been in the Schwab's in Hollywood. Nothing like this. There is nothing remotely like this. And we spent an evening in the drugstore. And I had this wild feeling of, isn't it fantastic how the American is blamed for everything all over the world and he doesn't have anything to do? It doesn't do any good to deny it. I mean, you just might as well go along with it and pretend like, oh, if you think this is a drugstore, you should see the drugstore at home. Oh, this is nothing compared to what we have. Oh, we have the drugstore covers 17, 15, maybe it's 20 block. We have seven-story drugstore. We have the... You know, and I'm sitting in the middle of this. Well, then about 10 minutes later, and it was one of those wild nightmare nights. We're sitting in this thing, and I'm eating this mocha sundae,
and trying to pretend like, you know, this is my scene, this drugstore scene. And we are now out in the night again. And 15 minutes later, I am in the middle of Saint-Germain-des-Prés. Has this ever taken off? I'll tell you, we are surging down a little tiny street, and we're in the middle of a gigantic teenage riot. And I mean a genuine riot. You know, you keep hearing about riot, teenage riots. It's a nameless, formless riot. You know, the riots that most of us are used to are riots with a purpose. This happened, this particular indignity, or this particular civil right, this particular thing. This was just a, and I was right there when it started. Right at the minute it started, in the middle of this thing. And we are surging down this little narrow street, and through it, there are about 75 guys driving in Renaults and Fiats, a guy with a Ferrari, looks like an Arabian prince on his night out. He's with this 9-year-old girl, and they're all driving this thing, and the people are jumping on the hoods, and there are kids running around. All of them look vaguely a little bit like, it's very difficult. You know, if you think we're having troubles here, I tell you, it is almost totally impossible to tell a French male from a French female if they're under 18. Impossible. I'll tell you, you can get yourself into some very embarrassing situations in France. And so here they're surging and yelling, and all of a sudden here I am in the middle of this with the French Count. I said, how the hell did I get myself in this? I'm with a French Count, I'm with Philippe and Gerard. And now Gerard is beginning to get very angry at the Corsican, because now he's finally, it's getting a little late, he wants to take his wife home, and he has realized that the hobby has gone so far enough now. And I begin to, you know, there's a little sense any minute now violence is going to break out in our crowd. And we're looking for our car, which we have lost, and we're surging down through this little narrow street. And all of a sudden, somebody he starts yelling out of the upper story window. He peers out, and I see this, and what's going to happen? Immediately, the crowd looks up, and this guy has a great big pan full of hot water. Shoom! Down it comes on the crowd, and it lands all over me and about 45 other guys, and instantly there's a riot. Instantly it starts to go. And I hear the windows crashing in, and I hear this, you know, that sound. Have you ever been in the middle of a rolling senseless violence? That sound. You just hear that. And you see guys jumping up in that wild-eyed look, and everybody's in a nutty way. When that happens, there's always one group of people who enjoy it wildly. And they begin to lash out. They begin to grab chicks, and you hear the windows crashing. And you see coming around, the French gendarme has approached. And they have a kind of riot car that is really frightening, I'll tell you this. They have about three different types of cars they drive, but they have one kind of horn, and it goes, ow, 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 ow. It just goes insanely, and the lights are flashing, and the gendarmes rush out, and we surge down the street in the direction of our car, and my coat is wet, and I've been wounded in action, you know, the whole business, and Gerard's coat has been torn, and you see this wild, moiling gang of teenagers leaping up and down on the hood of a Jaguar. Here was this beautiful XKE that was being destroyed by this mob. Some poor guy had left his car parked up on the sidewalk, and how they do in the middle of the great big Saturday night scenes in places like the Village and places like the Left Bank and here's somebody, and these kids were jumping up and down on the hood, and the policemen were coming out, oh, the poor guy. And I could hear ow, 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 and a wild screaming French imprecations, and now all of the people in the apartments all above us began to pour stuff down on the streets. And 5 minutes later, we're back in the car, and we are heading for the apartment after our wild night. After our night in the drugstore, Paris 2, the riot, and we are heading back towards the apartment and what was left of the cold chicken. And with that, Renault turns to me and he says, this, of course, he says, this kind of thing, he says, this never happened till the American was here. And I didn't see an American face anywhere. All those French faces, you know, yelling and screaming and breaking the windows. He says, this has not happened till the American was here. I said, well, I guess it didn't happen till I showed up tonight. That's probably true. And I bowed down and I realized that the life of the American in 1966 ain't easy. And I could see the lights in the sky as the kids were burning down the town, and the Eiffel Tower was toppling, and we drove back towards that quiet apartment. Do you want to hear tomorrow night? I'll tell you tomorrow night the story of the French desert and the hang-up that all the French have on what they think of as the American Wild West. You want to hear about that? I'll tell you. I don't know why people pay money to go into Disneyland when there's nothing in Disneyland that even remotely approaches real life, for fantasy, for ecstasy, for passion, for exoticism, for eroticism, the whole long line, the whole plastic scene of the mid-1960s. Wow, this is the American deep life, of course, you know.
This is WOR Radio, your station for news.
Palisades has a rise, Palisades.
WBAI, New York.
Come on over. Shows and dancing are free, so the parking's so cheap. Come on over.
Well, I guess that's all we get of the Palisades Amusement Park jingle. Palisades from coast to coast, where a dime buys the most. Palisades Amusement Park swings all day and after dark. Now, let's see. Is this when the pool is open or before? They cut out the little line here. Ride the coaster, get cool in the waves and the pool. They only run that during July and August, I think. You'll have fun! So, come on, Gene Shepherd from June 15th, 1966. And we will have another episode of Gene Shepherd in the usual 5:15 time slot, or thereabouts.